I'm reading from Barry Fell, America, D.C. Barry Fell is a Harvard professor who has pioneered myth-shattering research. Now, I said earlier, we're unreligious, but I am quite willing to be called religious if the proper meaning is on that word. If by religion you mean activities related to, focused on, or compelled by your ultimate values, then I'm very religious. Because there are some ultimate values that grab hold of me and control my life. But if I didn't believe in God, I've said several times, I would worship the opportunity to be free. And close behind that, the search for truth. And thank God I've studied in enough fields. I changed majors on every degree in college and university. As I look back, I thank God for it because it gave me an ability to gestalt across many disciplines and not be fooled so easily. I lost my faith in university by misplacing trust in men who presumed knowledge in areas that they didn't have. They transferred a justified expertise in the area of specialty to areas they had not specialized in. Historians, my undergraduate major was in history. My PhD at Stanford was in philosophies of education. And in between, I changed majors, as I said, on every degree and sometimes en route to several degrees. I learned scientists make mistakes and cover them up. In fact, I'll probably this week bring a book. The whole book is written on dishonesty in science. Now, I introduced here one night the great fraud of Darwin. Darwin did not discover the so-called theory. He stole it from a poor guy suffering from a fever in the Dutch East Indies. And because he was a member of the establishment, got some buddies to help him get the jump on it in the Royal Society. The man was a fraud. There's a lot of fraud in science. And history truly is his story, the guy who writes it. Now, this book will shatter some myths. And it's related to some things that we are teaching in the broader sphere, but I'm going to concentrate on it in a few minutes. Get ready to be bored. When we reflect upon the events of the past two centuries of America's nationhood, we perceive that the course of British and American history is shaped like the letter Y. The lower upright of the Y represents the common stream of Europe's cultural heritage, reading upward until we reach the fork of the Y, which represents 1776. Thereafter, America and Britain part company, each to pursue a separate path toward whatever destiny may lie in store. Now, it's an indisputable fact that not only has the history of the two English-speaking nations bifurcated like the arms of the Y, but also the teaching of history. British children continue to learn the history of Britain from remote Stone Age era. They're told through the Celts, the Roman invaders, and the Saxon invasions, the Norman invasion. Stone Age savages building Stonehenge that just happens to be lined up perfectly with the pyramid. That you can use not only as a great astronomical laboratory, to Gerald Hawkins and his computers to finally begin to demonstrate how smart the builders of Stonehenge were. But history keeps right on telling the same stupid story. Savages ever increasing upward. Man was awfully smart in the distant past. Something happened to make him awful dumb. And we're just starting to catch up again. British children learn the history of Britain from remotest Stone Age through the Celts, the Roman invaders, the Saxon invasions, the Norman invasion, so on through the Middle Ages to the present era. American children begin with an account of the benighted state of Europe in 1492 and lead directly, as you turn the first page, usually to a portrait of Christopher Columbus, followed by an account of his daring exploits and discoveries. There you have it in a nutshell. For Europe, history begins in a vague, remote, romantic mist of antiquity, slowly emerges into more recent time. For American history, history begins with the crash of symbols as great and famous men stride onto the stage, fully documented, or so nearly so that one might be pardoned for thinking that their birth certificates and Social Security cards are stored in the National Archives in Washington. Two English humorists in the book 1066 and all that suggested some years ago that there are only two dates in history that British people can remember. 55 B.C., when Julius Caesar landed in Britain, and 1066, and give me a little more microphone, 1066, when William the Conqueror conquered it. It is their mock serious thesis that since the common man in Britain remembers no other event well enough to date it, no other events exist in British history. Barry Fellow says, I suspect that an analogous satire on American history would have discovered essentially the same thing, except that the two dates every American remembers are 1492 and 1776. Hence, there can be no American history prior to 1492. Well, let's look. The year is 1712. Queen Anne rules in England by remote control, also in New England. Learned savants of the kingdom are at work studying ancient monuments and reporting their finds to the Royal Society in London. From Ireland, a famous Welsh antiquary named Edward Lloyd reports to the Society that he has just discovered a previously unknown kind of writing. Now write the year down, 1712. A Welshman, no less, reports to the Society he has just discovered a previously unknown kind of writing engraved on a stone at Trebeg near Dingle in County Kerry. Lloyd has no idea as to what the inscription might mean or what language it is written in. Now, by 1712, the shape of history, as interpreted to English-speaking people, was gelled in its broad frame. The Romans had conquered Greece, but the Greeks had Hellenized the Romans. And the Grecian culture had conquered the Romans, while the Romans gave them pragmatic ability to get things done, and power and law. And all flowed from that. And the church councils had settled it. The Bible had been canonized, fixed, encased in 66 books. And King James was good enough for Paul. And that settled it. Anybody ought to know that God would never limit his message and number it 66 books. I doubt he'd do it 69 or 61. That ought to tell you something, how divinely led the makers of that decision were. All the tribes were lost forever. The 10 tribes had disappeared and were lost. And all the promises of Abraham were concentrated in the Jews who came back from Babylonian captivity and had been dispersed by the Romans in 70 AD. The trunk of the tree was fixed. You could maybe grasp something on to the trunk already there. But the trunk was fixed, and that was that. The Greco-Roman centric view of the world was settled. And here comes this guy with an unknown kind of writing, 1712. He had no idea what the inscription might mean or what language it was written in, but he takes care to make a copy of it to send to the Royal Society. Hopefully, he reasons, sometime someone may discover a key to the writing system, and then perhaps the inscription may turn out to be important. At this point, action ceases in England on this particular problem. It goes in the archives. Meantime, across the seas in New England, a Puritan clergyman named Cotton Mather, you ever heard his name? Has discovered some strange writing on a rock at Dighton, Massachusetts. He also writes to inform the Royal Society in London of his find, because they were governing New England by remote control. When Cotton Mather found this, he too informed London of his find, and the same society duly records his letter in the Transactions of the Society for 1712. The mouth of two witnesses, the thing is confirmed. Oceans apart, same year, into the files of the society, these strange writings that have been discovered. No further advance. And that in the translation or study of these writings was made for two generations, during which time span America became a separate nation with her own learned societies publishing their own record of research and philosophical inquiry. An unfortunate result was that whereas Lloyd's inscription in Ireland continued to exercise the minds of the learned in Britain, Cotton Mather's report from New England now ceased to have any direct interest for British investigators. They weren't interested now in what was found by Cotton Mather in New England. And since Cotton Mather's find was recorded in the British Society Journal, it was simply forgotten in America. This was the parting of the ways of the British and American studies on the subject, as is well illustrated by the subsequent fate of the two reports that had been made in 1712. In contrast to the oblivion which now enveloped Cotton Mather's letter of the discovery in Massachusetts, the corresponding letter from Lloyd was to generate both a controversy and eventually enlightenment in England. More than 70 years later, write it down, June 24th. 1784. Am I boring you? A letter was received by the Society of Antiquaries in London from a certain Colonel Charles Valancy in Ireland, informing the Society that he had discovered an ancient Irish tombstone on Mount Caelan, County Clare. He had been able to decipher the writing on it, so he reported, and found that it marked the grave of an ancient Irish chieftain named Conan Colgac. This startling information was accompanied by an explanation of how the decipherment had been carried out, and how he had recognized the writing as a script called Ogham, identical with the unknown script that Lloyd had reported three generations earlier. Interesting. You want to know how Charles Valency achieved that? Well, he was the first of a long line of linguists who've been responsible for virtually every major decipherment in archaeology. Most of them have not been professional linguists teaching in a university department of languages, but rather men whose occupation requires them to deal with mathematical probability theory or algebra or some other activity involving the solution of mutually dependent variables. Then this guy teaches like I do. He says, in a later chapter, I'm going to tell you how Valency did it. Then he goes on another subject. He says, my own interest... Now, I can go over to the other chapter if I get persuaded enough. My own interest in language, the author goes on to say, stems from high school days. When I first began to collect miscellaneous Etruscan words quoted by Latin authors, and he's entitled to this audience, because Barry Fell has put together the research to prove the existence of Celts, those peoplers of the northwestern European communities, and most of the nations of northwestern Europe, particularly the British Isles, more particularly Ireland and Wales and Scotland, that those same Celts earlier than 500 B.C., were exploring this country, trading in this country, setting up burial monuments in this country, and writing in Celtic Ogham. You'll read book after book, says Celts had no written language. Well, they did. We may be dealing with even possibly the oldest written language of mankind. He deserves an audience since he's been criticized so much. My own interest in languages stems from high school days when I first began to collect miscellaneous Etruscan words quoted by Latin authors whose works we read. Later, I followed the works of Michael Ventris, a London architect who solved the writing called Linear B, that mysterious writing. And we're in the period when Napoleon's savants discovered the Rosetta Stone that enabled Champollion to break the hieroglyphic writings, and the discovery by Layard and Rawlinson that opened up cuneiform writings traced clear back to the Phoenicians, the Linear A and Linear B writings of the Minoan culture on Crete, a burst of knowledge breaking forth at the turn of the century, 1800. Ahead of them all had been discovered this Ogham writing lying in the Royal Society's archives until Valency comes along. Now Fell's telling his own story. He had followed the work of Michael Ventris, a London architect who solved the writing called Linear B, that Minoan writing along with Linear A from Crete, found on the ancient tablets of Crete. Like others at that time, I rejoiced in his final success, but mourned when his last paper arrived, accompanied by a letter from the Hellenic Society reporting his death in a street accident. Apart from an early interest in ancient languages for their own sake, my work as a marine biologist led me to investigate ancient Libyan inscriptions found on remote islands in the Pacific. For these seem likely to throw light on how man's dispersal across the earth may be influenced by winds and ocean currents. But the point I wish to make as I close this chapter, his opening chapter, is that the parting of the ways of American and British savants or learned scholars following the revolution meant that Valency's discovery passed unnoticed in New England. Both Cotton Mather and Lloyd, the Welshman's discovery of Ogham writings, were filed in the British Society in 1712. Because of the revolution and the separation, Cotton Mather's discovery was ignored by the British scholars because it was New England stuff. And American And the colonial, not the colonial, but the revolutionary and reformed constitutional nation had little time to research the royal files in Britain. So Cotton Mather's discovery was ignored. Likewise, when Delancey deciphered the first decipherment of Oldham writing, again it was ignored in America. It had no immediate connection to what Cotton Mather had discovered. If somebody had been interested in what Cotton Mather had filed with the Royal Society, they would instantly have seen that Delancey's discovery not only translated the Ogham in Ireland, but gave a basis for translating what Cotton Mather had found. But it was unnoticed in New England. The whole documentation of the oldest known literate Celtic society in the world, here in New England, even its very existence, was doomed to lie in limbo for two more centuries. Eight generations of American youth went to school, learned to think of the United States as a nation without historical roots in the soil of the New World, and without any tradition into the remote past, save the undocumented speculations of those who looked toward the Bering Straits as the one and only port of entry for pre-Columbian man. All Amerindian or American Indian languages were classed together as supposedly indigenous products of the New World, and the massive Phoenician, Libyan, and other Old World elements and their vocabularies passed undetected. We instantly, as a matter of scholarship, look for connecting cognate words among the various languages of the European continent. An immediate assumption was made: American Indian languages are totally unique, and if you're going to look for any cognates, go across the Bering Strait to Siberia and down to China and Japan. Nobody was looking for what, in fact, existed. Cognate Celtic words grafted into the American Indian languages. But since nobody was looking, nobody saw it. Scripts that have been deciphered and well documented in Europe have, when discovered in American contexts, generally been dismissed. That is, Ogham writings. Nobody remembering what Cotton Mather found. If anybody found any marks on any rocks in America, they were simply and generally dismissed as marks made by plowshares or the actions of the roots of trees scraping the rocks, leading to the ridiculous inference that the same must also be true in Europe. Bell says, when I surreptitiously introduced a well-authenticated Phoenician inscription from Sardinia into an exhibit of my American inscriptions and showed it at a lecture I gave in the Department of Archaeology at a well-known university, no one seemed to notice any difference between the Susquehanna or Pennsylvania stones and the Mediterranean intruder from Sardinia that I slipped in just to experiment. Indeed, there was a time when I found it hard to get any archaeological professor to examine inscribed stones. And when they did, as often as not, the inscriptions were held upside down or sideways. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The plain truth is that ancient languages are not usually studied by archaeologists in America. So the arbiters of such research here really had little or no knowledge of the ancient scripts, which they so readily dismissed as fortuitous markings made by the roots of trees or by plowshares. Happily, these obstacles to our work have now diminished, and many university teachers are now interested in this developing field. To the matter of plowshares and the marks they make, I've paid special attention, watching farmers at work in the field around me on my expeditions and discussing with them what happens when a plow strikes a stone. In point of fact, all that results is a dent. For either the stone flies out of the ground when it's struck, or the plow itself bounces off it, yet the stone doesn't move. The one device that farmers use capable of cutting grooves in stones is the chain with which they drag a large stone out of the ground, but such grooves are long and curving and bear not the slightest resemblance to any script known to me. Given such facts as these, it's not surprising that the theorists who seem to attribute the invention of writing to the plow, a little bit of humor there. Given such facts as these, it's not surprising that the theorists who seem to attribute the invention of writing to the plow have never explained how it is that plows in Pennsylvania usually ride in Basque or Iberian Punic, whereas those of New England are apt to ascend the walls of stone buildings to write Celtic ogham upside down on the ceilings. Little humor there. Perhaps the most pressing reform needed in courses in archaeology in America today is to introduce the study of epigraphy, by which is meant the art of reading ancient inscriptions engraved or otherwise imprinted on stone or other durable materials. The need for courses in this was brought home to me in no uncertain terms after the news media began to report some of these finds. Each week now brings me letters from many parts of the country enclosing photographs or drawings or rubbings of inscriptions people have found on their own properties or elsewhere and requesting an explanation. Many of these inscriptions are the work of later American Indians and are not writing in the strict sense. Many others are more or less illiterate but genuine records cut by the modern colonists and explorers. Illiterate, more or less, cut by modern colonists and explorers, often recording the death of a comrade on the trail or a visit of a survey party. And few are patent forgeries of which the finder becomes the innocent purveyor, but many others, and this book proves it abundantly with picture and text, are genuine ancient records and hence part of the cultural heritage of America. It is saddening to see that many cliff-cut, see, the whole world grieves as the Aswan Dam threatened the extinction of those great historic artifacts in the upper reaches of the Nile River. And some of them were moved wholesale to be preserved. How many canyons of dammed up rivers cover the cultural history of Celtic, Punic, and Libyan immigrations into this country 2,000 years before Columbus set out with his 50 men in a ship, because somebody was plowing and scarred a rock. It is saddening to see that many cliff-cut mementos of a visit by an ancient voyager have been overlaid by the recent scrawls of thoughtless vandals or shattered by the bullets fired at them by persons who think it incumbent to destroy otherwise enduring records cut into rock high above the normally destructive processes of flood or fire. All too often an ancient inscription has survived 2,000 years in the reverent custody of American Indian tribes only to be ruined by the ignorant sharpshooter of modern times. If we are to stop the destruction of these national archives, we must make it our business to inform people what these inscriptions represent, and that's what I'm about. Now, let's dig in. Am I boring you? Now, the theory I'm going to propose, and have been proposing, and quite prepared to prove abundantly, is that the lost tribes never disappeared. God knew where they were. He hid them until His time arrived to reveal them. And they were a smart bunch. I got a little book in front of me. Foes from the Northern Frontier. It's a whole book about Scythians. Now, if you want to know what a Scythian is, they were among the earliest mounted archers in antiquity. They were certainly among the most skilled, able even to fire backwards while riding at a gallop. According to Plato, the Scythians could shoot as easily with the left hand. The Benjamites fielded entire armies of left-handed slingers and archers. As with the right hand, relating that while galloping, they were able to hit a moving beast or a bird. Though the Scythians had other weapons such as battle axes, daggers, spears, and swords, they were most wedded to the bow. The Scythians are identified by their ability to ride on a horse and shoot an arrow, and by three-pronged arrowheads. So a whole book is spent here discussing these Scythians. Now, there were three groups of Scythians, he says on page 100. Get in close enough to see the word. Saka, beyond the sea Scythians. Can you get in close enough to pick that up, Mike? Can you see Saka? S-A-K-A? That's the only one of the three words you need to pick up on, because the rest of it means beyond the sea. Saka, beyond the sea. Well, why did he turn that into beyond the sea Scythians? The name is Saka. Well, the Scythians, because they ride horses and shoot bows, they have arrows with three prongs on them. Second group of Scythians, Saka. Can you get it up there? Now, this is a very scholarly study. Another group of Saka. Saka, who ate or pressed the haoma plant. A hallucinogenic plant. They took dope. And the third group are pointed hat Saka, that he calls pointed hat Scythians because of the way they dress. Why is he calling Scythians that are called Saka? Saka simply means it's the Persian name for Isaac. And Saka Sunni means sons of Isaac. We had to have the Behistun stone and Darius inscription to learn what the Persians called the lost tribes. And the Assyrians called them Beth Qumri, house of Qumri, or Qumri, the sixth king that changed the capital to Samaria. It wasn't until the archaeology of the 1800s that we were able to finally find out their new names. Why is he calling Saka Scythians? Because Scythians simply is a generic term derived from the Hebrew word skuth, which is the word for the Feast of the Tabernacles. Skuth are those who lived in booths. Saka, who lived in tents and moved around. They are the lost tribes that Darius says within 50 years of their captivity, millions of them joined with the Medes and helped to overthrow the Assyrians, became mercenaries and marauders. Now, in this study of the Scythians, he's trying to prove the opposite of what he proves. He ends up like that fellow who went to the pyramid to prove that there was no sacred cubit measuring device in it and ended up proving it. Or Davidson, who went down to prove there was no prophetic message in the pyramid and ended up proving it. It's too hot in here. Give me some cooler, by the way. Now, as I read this book, I just got it marked page after page. He just keeps coming up with a simple little statement. The arrowheads identify them. Such arrowheads appear only after the incursion of the Scythians in the late 8th and early 7th century. Like the Celts, the Saka, the Scythians, the Celts all appear in the same place, and that's the place where the lost tribes disappeared. Qumri is the name the Assyrians put on them. Saka is the name the Persians put on them. Scythians describe their behavior and ultimately was related to their arrows, and they were the Celts, who populated northwest Europe and represent the house of Joseph, equally recipient of promises of God as the Jews represent the house of Judah. And Ezekiel 37 says, before the end comes, they must be joined together again and realize their heritage, which means God, at a given time, was going to make it possible to discover the heritage of these people. They didn't stop in Britain. 500 B.C. is 300 years, 221 years to be exact, after the fall of Samaria, 239 years after Manasseh is taken into bondage. By 650, middle of the 7th century, they have determined to move through the Caucasus Mountains to Arsareth, north of the Black Sea. They've become mercenaries with the Medes. They've become mercenaries, ultimately, with the Persians, mercenaries with the Egyptians, mercenaries wherever fighting men were, noted by Herodotus as traveling in wagons and carrying all of their belongings, living in scooths, outdoor tabernacles or tents. Wave after wave of these tribes swept across northwest Europe. Within 200 years, they are reaching the Scandinavian coasts and are settled in Ireland. In 500 B.C., about 545, is when Jeremiah disappears with the daughters of Zedekiah, descendants of David, from Egypt with the promises of God that he and his remnant will be preserved. And within 3 to 5 years, this old man named Olamphala shows up with a servant named Simon Breck or Brogue and the daughter of a king that's married to the High King of Ireland. And the only place in the world that points to a grave and calls it Jeremiah's grave is in Ireland. It's his picture that's engraved in the High Court at Dublin. And at the same time, he's arriving in Ireland on the ships that plied the Mediterranean Sea all the way from Israel, where one of the apocryphal books says he went back and hid certain of the treasures of the temple. Others he took with him, and he arrives with a stone called Leofail, or Stone of Destiny, on which the kings of Ireland and subsequently Scotland and now England are crowned, still called Jacob's Pillar. They didn't stop there. These Celts penetrated all the way to America. In March 1493, the Catholic Church was presented with an unforeseen problem. Christopher Columbus had just landed in Lisbon after an 8 months voyage that was to have taken him to the Indies. But instead of so doing, it led him to discover a new world. The difficulty now confronting the prelates was that he had returned with passengers, Amerindians, who had all the appearance of being human beings. Well, how could their existence be accounted for? The prelates debated. The biblical account of creation described three continents, each occupied by the seed of the three sons of Noah, who survived the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Columbus seems already to have been aware of the impending theological problem, for in a letter dated February 15, 1493, written at the Canary Islands, he assures King Ferdinand that the people he found were no monsters, but on the contrary, very well formed. Neither were they Negroes, he said. Bad word in that day and still. And when he put ashore in Lisbon on March 6th, his journal records, many people came to see the Indians, and it was a great marvel. As the second and third and later voyages produced ever-mounting evidence of a large number of man-like creatures inhabiting the Americas, I'm getting mad already because I got some Cherokee blood in me. A cold wind of skepticism began to blow through the monasteries to ruffle the peace of those who so boldly preached traditions as absolute truth. For a time, Rome disregarded the matter, as Pope Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia, was otherwise engaged, save only when he found time to draw a line of demarcation between the Spanish and Portuguese portions of the New World. But in 1512, a new pope, Giuliano della Rovere, Julius II, summoned the Fifth Lateran Council and issued an official declaration of the Church certifying that American Indians are true descendants of Adam and Eve and hence human beings. I just squeaked in. Now, I conducted a church council with me and God present a few years ago and determined that bureaucrats did not descend from Adam and Eve. They're not human beings. They're the missing link. The failure of the Bible to account for them, the Catholic Church, and their continent had to be explained. So it was made good by the inference that the American Indians were the descendants of the Babylonians, expelled from the old world on account of the sins of their ancestors. Backed by this authority, it was now safe for speculative churchmen to ponder the route from the Garden of Eden to America. After considering the possibilities that Noah's Ark might have added an American port of call to her scheduled sailing plan, or that angels might have transported people across the ocean, holding them with a hair of the head like to the prophet Habakkuk, a Spanish thinker, José de Acosta, dismissed both propositions in favor of transportation by shipwreck and accidental tempest of weather. I mean, they had great debates over that. Am I boring you? The inquiry was now taken up by others. And by the 17th century, both Protestant and Catholic churchmen were agreed that Asia must have been the original homeland of the American Indian forefathers, because only the rude Tartars, above all nations on earth, resemble the inhabitants of America in respect to their gross ignorance of letters and the arts and their idolatry, and above all, their incivility. They just weren't very civil. Alas for Pocahontas. There was no Fenimore Cooper on hand to defend the Six Nations, no Deerslayer yet to win hearts or minds for the dwellers in the wilderness. One dissident, Cotton Mather, in Boston. Now, Pope Julius' theory shows genealogy. Here's Adam and Eve, sinful Babylonians, and over here is Noah the righteous, his spouse and their children, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sinful Babylonians, most of them destroyed by the flood, some banished to the wilderness, American Indians. That's the way the Pope worked it out. That's why Hans Kuhn says, papal infallibility needs another look. One dissident, Cotton Mather in Boston, in the course of a long series of extraordinary letters to the Royal Society in London, now we're getting the detail on that earlier thing, drew attention to the existence in Connecticut of a tribe of Indians who practiced circumcision before Columbus got here. Thereby showing, he thought, that the American Indians should be considered as the lost tribes of Israel. Well, you know, the Mormons believe that for different reasons. Can you imagine? Circumcised Indians. Before. Columbus got here. They must have learned it in Babylon. Voltaire, on the other hand, considered that the American Indians had arisen de novo, just brand new, just sprung up in America by whatever mechanism had similarly caused human beings to appear upon the face of the earth and other continents. Even Voltaire wouldn't let them come out of the same tree. I'm getting mad at him now. I got some Cherokee blood in me. These are famous names. Nobody tells some of their prejudice. How many of you know mankind is very good at prejudice? By 1811, such scientists as Humboldt recognized the similarities between some American tribes and those of the Mongol race, and postulated that the American Indians are descended from a mingling of ancient Americans and later in-wanderers from Asia. Later still, most anthropologists came to agree that all American Indians are descended from ancestors that entered the Americas by way of the Bering Strait, and that no European came to America before Leif Erikson or Columbus. In recent years, one lone voice has protested such oversimplification, that of Harold Sterling Gladwin. In his various writings, Gladwin has repeatedly drawn attention to cultural features and material objects, particularly pottery, that show that American tribes must have had relatively recent contacts with the Old World, especially the Mediterranean and the Orient. The nature of the various arts... Am I boring you? I've been going almost an hour. God. The nature of the various art styles to which he drew attention is such as to point to direct voyages between the Old World and the Americas as late as classical times, about 2,000 years ago. Gladwin's views have, until very recently, been ruled anathema. You know, every time somebody rules me anathema, I just pull out my research studies and say, boy, I'm in a good crowd. Truth has had a hard row to hoe. You know that? There are a lot of stupid people in the world. They watch other stations. Gladwin's views have until very recently been ruled anathema and excluded from the college curricula. Luckily, this exclusionist attitude is now considerably ameliorated. His writings, once forbidden reading, have even become prescribed texts at places such as Harvard University. For generations, the archaeological world has been beset with the notion that only the navigational techniques introduced in Europe in the 15th century made it possible for Europeans across the Atlantic. So at the time when Gladwin issued Men Out of Asia in 1947, he too felt compelled to bring the Mediterranean influence to the Americas by way of an Asian or Indonesian land-hopping route. In recent years, new discoveries in the Pacific caves... Well, what he goes on to say is, there's a lot of evidence now to show that they had the ships to make the trip. The ships that fought against Julius Caesar were bigger and more seaworthy in that Celtic Armada or Armada than that little old piddling ship that Columbus made the trip in that would only handle about 50, 60 men. Caves, an inscription in America, have now begun to lend much support to that pioneer theory of Gladwin of contacts between the worlds. What, it is reasonable to ask, is this newer evidence? In fact, it's not new at all. It's lain intact for 2,000 years. All that's new is our ability to read the inscriptions. For indeed, there are written, and in some sense documents, carefully engraved on the bedrock of America, on temple lintels, on the gravestones of kings and chiefs, and they speak to us of a long-forgotten age of exploration and colonization, the subject of this book. When American archaeologists first began to send me inscriptions for decipherment and translation, I was astonished to learn that such documents exist here. All my earlier work had been on ancient tablets and cave inscriptions of the Old World, records of the Sea Peoples of the Bronze Age. The Sea Peoples included the Philistines. And it was the Sea Peoples and their excursions against Egypt and other places resulting in the Philistines settling on the coast of Palestine to become the perennial enemies of Israel. What he's saying is, I've read these inscriptions in my studies for years. Now I begin to see them in America. What I now begin to receive from unimpeachable sources in North America were essentially the same types of documents, engraved in stone and either excavated from some archaeological site, recorded from cliff faces, or photographed on massive rocks discovered by the early colonists. I had never seen such materials mentioned or illustrated in books on the archaeology of America or the Americas, and was at that time oblivious of their existence. How is it, I ask my friend and colleague, Professor George Carter of Texas, that you are sending me all these materials? Has no one studied them before? His answer was, for 25 years I've been knocking on the study doors of professors of Greek and Latin, each time to be told that the objects I had in my hand look like writing, but that it is not Greek or Latin or any script known to my consultants, so I emerge no wiser than before. The very manner in which George Carter and I were brought together is in itself instructive, for it illustrates both the difficulties now besetting communication between men working in different disciplines, and that's why I said earlier I was so glad I changed majors through every degree, and the strengths of those more liberal institutions of learning that encourage their faculty to cross the lines that divide the disciplines. See, when I was doing my PhD at Stanford, they were pioneers in that area. They were experimenting with PhDs in humanities that crossed departments. That's why I did a cross-departmental degree in the School of Education with Larry Thomas in philosophy, and in the religion department with Lex Miller. Three different departments cooperating to get the cross-fertilization through the disciplines. Carter trained as an archaeologist at the University of California at Berkeley, but he's chosen to devote much of his life to the study of the geographical distribution of man and his domesticated plants and animals. Through his researches, and I want to take the time to read this, because if I just started back here, you'd think I found some kind of book produced by somebody in a seance. These are Harvard, Berkeley, major professors at major universities. Through his researches at Johns Hopkins and later at Texas A&M, his work became well known to biologists at Hartford, especially to botanists working on the evolution and distribution of plants cultivated by man. I, for my part, though a marine biologist, have spent much of my life studying the ancient voyages of people who left inscriptions on remote islands, which of course could only have been approached by sea. As a marine biologist, I felt obliged to examine this evidence, for it would have a bearing on how the dispersal of man, plants, and animals might be influenced by ocean currents and winds. So the decipherment of ancient inscriptions, the art of epigraphy, became my second specialty. It was through my fellow biologists at Harvard that Carter and I were introduced to each other's work. I learned that he had amassed a fine collection of American inscriptions in the hope that their eventual decipherment might explain or illuminate his own researches, and he, for his part, now found a man who claimed to recognize languages on his tablet. We soon found that the emerging information is consistent with our other independent investigations, and so the seal was set on a collaboration that proved most rewarding. When word began to appear in linguistic and archaeological periodicals of this joint effort, other archaeologists and some linguists contacted us. A flow of information now began that soon swelled to proportions far beyond anything either George Carter or I had dreamed. The Epigraphic Society was established, and we began to publish our findings as well as those of others in a form readily available to other interested people, both professional and amateur. Yet, how many of you heard of it? Very few. So began the busiest and most productive period of my life. An exciting journey through space and time, bringing new friendships in a score of countries. From the information we gleaned from the first American tablets to be deciphered, we gained important hints as to where more inscriptions might be expected. So I deserted my study table and the world of dictionaries for a while to spend a wonderful summer crisscrossing the hills and valleys of the New England countryside, rejoicing whenever a terrace or ridgetop yielded yet another inscribed stone. My field companions and I became deeply aware of the presence all around us of traces of a vanished civilization that had once flourished there. On these New England excursions, I was most often accompanied by John Williams, a young schoolteacher from Connecticut, who soon made himself expert in detecting the presence of inscribed rocks beneath the soil and later carried out many exploratory trips on his own. Between the two of us, we covered some 11,000 miles on the roads and hundreds of miles on foot, clambering up hillsides and more often pushing through the woodlands that once more occupy much of the backcountry. When the suggestion was made at one stage in one of the newspapers that we might be forging the inscriptions, it became increasingly necessary to have cameras with us, as well as witnesses on hand to record the thick coat of lichens covering the inscriptions before they were brushed clean for making a plaster cast. Other companions from time to time were our archaeologist friends and local residents. The alphabet skipping along and the languages found on American inscriptions are fully discussed later in this book. But the representative examples on pages 21 and 22, which I'm going to show you, I wish you could see it on radio, show how the American colonists or visitors wrote in the first millennium B.C. Note the similarity to corresponding examples in Europe. Now here are examples of Iberian inscriptions from North America left and from Europe right. The American inscription engraved on a stone tablet was found in 1838 at a depth of 60 feet in a large burial mound at Grave Creek, West Virginia, together with a skeleton and copper arm rings. It was at once recognized by Professor Raffin of Copenhagen as being Iberian, though that script had not at that time been deciphered. Recent studies show that the language of the tablet is Punic Phoenician, written in the form of alphabet used in Spain during the first millennium B.C. It may be translated as follows, reading from Hebraic style, right to left. The mound, this is what this says, the mound raised on high for Tosuk, this tile, his queen caused to be made. Written in Phoenician language, characteristic of the Iberian Peninsula in the first 1,000 years B.C. The alphabet of the tablet was deciphered by Spanish scholars and published by the English epigrapher D. Derringer in 1968. The language is basic Semitic, and all words occur in standard literary Semitic dictionaries, such as that of Professor Weir. The decipherment of the tablet is explained by Fell in one of his own publications by the Epigraphic Society. The European inscriptions, with which scholars such as Raffin and Schoolcraft compared the Grave inscription, or Grave Creek inscription, shown to the right, is written Iberian alphabet, Punic language, alternate lines read right to left and then from left to right, called by a word that means as a plowman walks. They read back and forth. The translation, various ways of making a prediction, the planet reveal indications of, letters missing. He who understands how may himself obtain information about hidden truths. When the radiant gleam is seen in the myriads of the heavenly hosts, follow their courses on high, and on it goes. And Venus is mentioned. She bestows upon mankind peace and mild government. Obviously a part of an astrological text. Same language, both places in this country. Now, while John Williams and I roamed the New England backcountry for Celtic inscriptions, another colleague was making notable finds in the Midwest and Southwest. This was Gloria Farley, an intrepid explorer of the cliffs and caves that border the banks of the Arkansas and Cimarron rivers and their tributaries. Armed with cameras, snake bite, antivenom, rubber latex for making impressions, and a ladder, Gloria systematically assembled a remarkable series of records of visits and settlements by European voyagers who had ascended the Mississippi, then turned west to follow the Arkansas River, eventually to reach the Cimarron along the border between Oklahoma and Colorado. Her discovery showed that some Celts had followed this southern route, and that Libyans and Phoenician-speaking Iberians, and even one Basque king, had ventured into the heartland of the continent centuries before Christ. How was the Irish Ogham deciphered that enabled Fell and others who studied the inscriptions and learned Irish Ogham to suddenly unearth what had been buried since Cotton Mather's day, that very same Ogham enabled them to write, to read rather, these inscriptions that had lain for 2,000 years in the American continent? How was it discovered? the Ogham Tract. But I'm not going to go any further. We've got to leave Channel 56. Bless their poor little pointed heads. It takes big brains to stay 24 hours a day at this. Some stations can't handle it. But if you're still up and listening, I don't know what in the world this has done to Malibu and Arizona. And nobody in Allentown stays up this late. If I'd keep teaching a while, I'd get them while they're getting up. But are you still there? Am I boring you? Well, I don't know. You call. The song is I Want to Know. 1-800-338-3030 is the number. If you are glad I'm back to teaching and like what we're doing and interested in it, I want to know. The poor Mandans were nearly wiped out by the great smallpox epidemic of 1837 and those left alive scattered to other tribes. Thereafter, the search for the Welsh Indians resumed. That's where I was. Brigham Young, this paragraph, was still looking for them in the western deserts in 1854. Then he starts poo-pooing. That's all he's done. Poo-poo every one of these theories. He's a great poo-pooer. He must have a pee-pee degree. Poo-poo. He says, the usual announcement of their discovery says that a particular tribe, the Caribs, the Mandans, the Flatheads, or whatnots, use Welsh words, such as that for cow. Though it's hard to see how any American Indians could have had a word for cow in pre-Columbian times when there were no cows in the Americas. How's he know? They were sailing ships big enough to haul 200 men, and they usually took cows on them. How's he know? He's just full of poo-poo. I'm going to read America BC just on the point. He's poo-pooing the idea that words are in American Indian languages that are Welsh or Celtic words. Well, let's just read something to you. Oh, it's interesting. Very interesting. But I want to find something that's more interesting. That's interesting, too. Now, this is America BC by the Harvard professor, Barry Fell. He deals in facts, not poo-poo. Let's just talk about the Libyans for a moment. Not only did the Welsh ancestors, the Celts, and the Scottish ancestors, the Celts, and primarily the Irish ancestors, the Celts, and British ancestors, the Celts, and the Norsemen ancestors, the Celts, come over to this land. So did Phoenicians. And so did Libyans. The coming of the Libyans is still one of the most mysterious of the colonial episodes of American history. We have so far found relatively little in the way of coastal inscriptions. This is America B.C. by Barry Feld. Somebody said they called the Ontario bookstore and asked if they had it, and they were told to get on a waiting list. Why are you doing that, folks? We got them ordered from New York. We bought out New York on these. These will be, when will they be in, Joe? About a week. So a week from Sunday, they'll be in Doc's Intelligence Center. And you can order them right here from me. Why are you going to run around to these bookstores? Well, I'll make a mailman bring it to you. One problem is I don't know what it costs. What are they retail for, Joe? It's his anniversary. He's got his mind on other things. We don't know what it's worth, but it's the same price it is in any other bookstore. So what are you running around for? The coming of the Libyans is still, am I boring you? One of the most mysterious, I mean, if Libyans got here, the Celts could sure get here. I mean, I'm not putting down the Libyans, but they're better at riding camels than they are sailing boats. They're great camel riders, and it's a lot harder to ride a camel than it is to ride a boat, so that doesn't put them down at all. But I mean, if they made it, the coming of the Libyans is still one of the most mysterious of the colonial episodes of American history. We have so far found relatively little in the way of coastal inscriptions to tell us the time of their arrival or of their portals of entry into the land. Boy, I'm telling you, Columbus pulled off the coup of the century. Just a few telltale written fragments from scattered points, including one from as far north as Quebec, one from California, and others from cliff faces along the Arkansas and Cimarron rivers in the southern Midwest, and nothing else. Nothing else. Nothing more until, listen, the year 1879. When the U.S. Bureau of Ethnology was established. By the way, most Libyans were good at camel riding, but Jason, of so-called mythological fame, with his 50 Danans searching for the Golden Fleece, landed in Libya. And like all sailors, had an affair or two. And some of them stayed and marched south and became the Dogons of Mali, who worshiped the star you can't see, that somebody like Columbus discovered 4,000 years after they started worshiping it. Interesting little connections. Now, those that were closely related to Jason were pretty good boatmen. Just thought I'd throw that in. Nothing more until the year 1879, when the U.S. Bureau of Ethnology was established and began their investigations of the Zuni country of New Mexico. Unusual features of the Shiwi and Hopi tribes had already come to the attention of Professor J. Walter Fuchs. An interesting name. Like me, Fuchs was a marine biologist at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard. See, these aren't a bunch of dummies. And of James Stevenson. Continued work with these and other parties led to the publication of important memoirs and the preparation for the first time of Zuni linguistic and lexicographic materials. See, I did my doctorate with Richard Dettering. He was working on his doctorate at Stanford University. Recently himself out of San Francisco State. He did this PhD dissertation on a remote Indian tribe's language where every time the verbs change, the nouns change. This kind of study is very recent. While examining Pueblo materials at the Peabody Museum of Archaeology at Harvard University, my attention was attracted to a white leather sun disc that, according to its label, had been obtained from New Mexico after a religious ceremony of the Shiwi or Zuni in 1891. On it are painted "Repent, every damn one of you, for thinking what you thought at that moment." You ought to be ashamed of yourselves. How many of you thought I was going to stop right there? Put your hands up and confess. You haven't got any faith. Whatsoever is not of faith is sin. People in New York and Pennsylvania and Arizona and San Francisco and New England, they knew I was going to keep going. People in Malibu knew I was going to keep going. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Come here with a different attitude from now on. On it are painted. On it are painted. It is a white leather sun disc that, according to its label, had been obtained from New Mexico after a religious ceremony of the Zuni in 1891. On it are painted. On it are painted the Libyan letters, TM, a formula adopted in Egypt as the phonetic rendering of Atum, the primeval sun god of North Africa. The Libyan language is basically Egyptian combined with Anatolian roots, and there's a whole chapter on that here. The Libyan language is basically Egyptian combined with Anatolian roots introduced by the sea peoples who invaded Libya. Now, there's an interesting thing. Do you know where Anatolia is? How many of you know where the Anatolia plateau is? Somebody hold your hand up. Well, as geographers, you didn't make it. That's the area where the tribes went. That's the area from which Jason and his golden fleece came, his Argonauts. As much as he knows, he didn't connect that. That's what a gestalt of all the subjects does for you. That's where the people came who came and camped and brought from Egypt the knowledge as they came by the pyramid that the Dogon people picked up on. Interesting, isn't it? That the Libyan language is a combination of Egyptian and Anatolian roots. The written form of the language is like that of the Phoenicians, alphabetic, but using only consonants. Who were the sea peoples? Well, they included Danites and Phoenicians, Philistines. The records of the Bureau of Ethnology for 1891 disclose that Dr. Matilda Stevenson attended all the solar solstice ceremonies of the Zuni clans, winter and summer in that year, and that she collected some cult objects. Her report, Stevenson, 1904, includes a number of photographs and paintings in which well-known solar cult motifs of the Mediterranean type are visible on the altars, though she didn't identify them as such. If you're just a specialist, you know, you miss some of the gestaltic interconnections. For these reasons, I examined the etymology of the Zuni language using vocabularies that Bernard Lehman located for me in the Wiedner and other libraries. The results of this inquiry convinced me that the Zuni tongue is largely derived from North African dialects the linkage being very marked with Coptic, Middle Egyptian. Now, Coptic is ancient Egyptian written in Greek. Coptic, Middle Egyptian, and Nubian of the Nile Valley. While there is evidence of much loan vocabulary from adjacent tribes, from the Algonquin dialects to the north and Mexican tongues to the south, the main vocabulary of the Zuni Indians is North African, and you can't talk Zuni with one word, cow. That's the point of this. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
My conclusion, then, and there is a chapter here, if we had about 10 hours and could go through it. It's called Alphabets Galore. Abidial Gulior, which is Gaelic, and I didn't pronounce it right, I will assure you. But I know what the meaning of it is. It's alphabets to repletion. You ever wondered where the word galore comes from? To repletion. It's ancient Gaelic. Carried over into this language. So we know that English got its word galore. And we grow up saying, my Lord, ice cream galore. It's to repletion. Too much abundance. More than is needed. It's a Gaelic word, just cognate, carried over. The word church, you know, comes from kirken in the Greek, which means the Lord's. Ecclesiastical, ecclesia, out called once. Words travel from language to language, and cognates are borrowed from another tongue. Well, the chapter on alphabets galore analyzes Ogham. If you want to learn to write Ogham, you can learn to write it right here. Got your whole alphabet. Those above and below the stem. Give me a picture. And all what each letter means. That's B L F V S N H D T C Q M G N with the little curl above it that makes you pronounce it nyan, like the Spanish canyon. S Z R, and then some special vowels and diphthongs down here. Learn to write Ogham. This traces the languages that have been found in this country. Here's Gwynn, an early Celtic explorer of Oklahoma, cut his autograph in two languages on the rock face on Turkey Mountain. Nobody ever paid any attention to this until Delancey finally translated Ogham. The uncovering of Ogham ought to get as much credit as the Rosetta Stones, but because all the positions have been taken by the scholars that the source of all knowledge was Egypt, Greece, and Rome, and more Greece and Rome than Egypt, it's taken a century of tough-minded realists to uncover the fact that as we make void the Word of God by our traditions, a lot of people make void the truth by scientific traditions. Here's a two-language inscription, an autograph on Turkey Mountain near Tulsa. Ogham script is up on the top. It reads from left to right, Gwyn, which means white or fair haired. The Punic word below is Paya, which means white. His inscription is in two different words, Punic, which is Phoenician, and Celtic. He goes on to trace the main three streams are Libyan, Ogham, and Phoenician. Celtic, Ogham, and Phoenician. And Ogham was also written by the Phoenicians. Everybody gives the Phoenicians credit for pioneering cuneiform writings. They had Ogham before that. My conclusion then is that the Zuni language should be reclassified as an American branch of the North African group. Now, we have Indo-European languages that have a common bond. Now, instead of this being a language that was brought by somebody over the Bering Strait out of an Asiatic stream, this Zuni language should be reclassified as an American branch of the North African group, which otherwise comprises the belt of so-called Afro-Asian tongues of mixed Semitic Hamitic origin, a mixture of Semitic tongues that came down from the Turkish plateau, brought by those meandering Celts, and also Phoenicians, who were but the descendants, Pahanak of Enoch, and that's what the Semites are. Noah was too. Shemites. The mixture of those Celtic languages, Semitic, and the Egyptian language produced the Libyan tongue, stretching from the Moroccan Berber area near Gibraltar across the southern coastlands of the Mediterranean to Somalia in the east, and including in former times the ancient Libyan, ancient Egyptian, Coptic, and Ethiopian languages. In the view of the discovery of the ancient Libyan inscriptions in the places I've indicated, and the evident concentration of such few inscriptions as we have in the southern parts of the United States, I think it probable that the ancestors of the Shiwi people of Zuni are the same visitors from Libya who cut the ancient inscriptions. During the 1930s, excavations in New Mexico by a Harvard team and associated investigators brought to light a previously unknown, that's where I'm going to stop,